One of the idiosyncrasies of the English language is that while it holds perhaps one of the greatest vocabularies of any language, it can also be extremely imprecise and misleading. As you know, the English language has borrowed all of its grammar and vocabulary from just about every other main language or dialect in the world, from Latin to French, Greek to Roman, gobbledygook to gibberish. As one writer notes, not only does the English language borrow words from other languages, it sometimes chases them down dark alleys, hits them over the head, and goes through their pockets. Take, for instance, the English word you. Now, if I were to look someone in the eye and say something like, "I want you to see me after the service," there'd be no doubt in anyone's mind about whom I was referring to. And if I said it like that, you would probably want to start feeling guilty about now. But if, in the context of my sermon, I was to say something like, "You need to spend more time reading the Bible," you'd probably understand that I was not just addressing one individual, but the entire congregation. The word "you" is the same in both contexts, but it's easily distinguishable, so there's little confusion. There are, however, situations where the distinction is perhaps a little less precise. When it comes to translating the scriptures from the original Greek or Hebrew into English, scholars have to decide how best to use English words to give the best sense of the original language. And when no such distinctives are available, the work of the translator becomes more difficult. We find one of these language difficulties in today's reading from Matthew's account of the Gospel, and it concerns the use of the word "you." Now, when Jesus says to Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" the tendency is to think Jesus is addressing Peter alone. Pardon me. We get this notion from the fact that it is only Peter who verbally responds to the question. The word "you" in Jesus' question, however, is not the singular form of the word. It is, in fact, the plural form of the word. You see, in the Greek, the words are different and the plural aspect of the question is made clear. In English, however, it is less clear. So, since the word "you" in the Greek here is plural, it means that Jesus is not just asking who Peter thinks Jesus is. He's asking who all the disciples think Jesus is. In other words, Jesus' question is to all of them. And Peter's answer represents the answer of all of them. And not only all of them then, but the whole church then and today. Peter's confession of faith is the church's confession of faith. Indeed, it is our confession of faith. When we as individuals confess that Jesus is the Messiah, we're not speaking on our own account. We are in fact confessing what the church says who Jesus is. Now, some may see that as pedantics or play on words or maybe just theological gobbledygook, but that's not the case. As Christians, we need to understand the difference. There are two aspects to this question that Jesus poses to his disciples that I want to address this morning. The first is, what does it mean for the church to confess corporately who Jesus is? And second, what does it mean for us as individuals to confess who Jesus is? Now, you're no doubt aware that the church today is undergoing a terrible assault from a number of quarters. The Christian church as a whole is having to address all kinds of social and religious pressures to conform the church's distinctive beliefs into fitting somehow in with the thinking of contemporary society. Now, a few years ago, I came across a sermon on this text by another minister while I was doing some research. And this minister began her sermon on our text for today by addressing the doubts that we all have from time to time concerning our faith. I thought a good place to start. She confessed that there was a time when she herself had in fact been influenced by the world around her and had subsequently lost her faith completely. Well, I suppose it can happen to the best of us. She then said that she had reached the point where she didn't believe in God, and the concept of God held no relevance for her life. Pretty normal, I guess, for our society. And she said that she lived this way for some time until she realised that there really was a God. I thought, aha, things are looking up. And that this God was the God within her. And then I thought, what? the same God that, according to her, is within all of us. Now, wait just a minute. What is she trying to say here? Jesus, she says, was a man who was so in touch with his inner God that he could be considered as both human and divine. And she went on to elaborate on the potential that we all have to achieve great things when we can learn to tap in, as it were, to this inner God or power. Now, I don't know about you, but it all sounds a bit New Agey to me. For a sermon that seemed to start really well, by the end it had fallen in a heap on the floor. Now, before I go on, I want to make one thing quite clear, and that is that this woman's understanding of who God is and her confession of who Jesus is for her is not the same as what Paul says in Matthew's account of the gospel. Nor is her confession of who Jesus is the same as what the church says about who Jesus is. This minister has, I believe, become a victim of the very compromise of the church's beliefs that I mentioned earlier. Another aspect of what is essentially the same mindset is the idea of religious pluralism that many quarters of the church are embracing with passion, which says that all religions basically believe the same God, but understand God in different ways. It's an attempt to try to find common ground for faith and spirituality, to create dialogue with people of other faiths. Now, that's a fairly noble goal, I agree, and we should be in dialogue with people of other faiths for all sorts of reasons. However, at the end of the day, what it actually does is insult everyone's faith, including our own, because it attempts to bring belief in God and the dynamic of the faith down to its lowest common denominator. And I don't believe you can do that with any degree of success. It ends up excluding the very distinctive characteristics of not only other people's faiths, but more importantly, the Christian faith as well. What first appears as graciousness towards other faiths, suggesting that we're all heading in the same direction after all, is actually the height of arrogance. It's saying that another person's beliefs are really unimportant and insignificant. It fails to take into consideration that a person's religious belief is, for many, the most important thing in his or her life. Look at the number of wars that religious beliefs have caused. You see, every religion has its own distinctive characteristics. And Christianity, which stands, I think, apart from all of the others, is defined by its distinctive understanding of who we believe Jesus to be. To say that that aspect of our faith is unimportant is to deny what the church has said about Jesus for the past 2,000 years. It is to deny the confession of the church and its precursor, Peter's confession of faith. In these examples, Jesus is reduced to being merely a prophet, a religious idea or ideal, a moral advocate. Faith becomes just a pious platitude to promote happiness and well-being, and unfortunately, this is where many liberal Christian theologians have gone. But when Peter confessed of Jesus, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," he was saying something very different to this. Jesus is not the embodiment of some vaguely religious emotions and pious platitudes. He is not just a moral advocate whom we should emulate in our lives. He is Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, someone who lived, spoke, and died in a very specific way, who claimed to be an image of God the Father, incarnate in human flesh. And it was possible to get him wrong, as Matthew's account of the conversation demonstrates. Remember, Jesus began by asking what everybody else said about him. He was widely recognized among the people as a mighty man of God, even being compared with the greatest of the prophets, John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah. But everything nice that people said of Jesus, such as he's a great prophet or a wonderful teacher of wisdom or a fine moral example, was not accepted by Jesus as truthfully describing who he was. And then Jesus asked his disciples, "But who do you say that I am?" When Peter makes this stunning confession, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," Jesus doesn't say to Peter, "Oh, great, now you've got the point, go out and arm wrestle everyone else into seeing things the way you see them." Jesus says instead, "Blessed are you, Simon, Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. In other words, Peter, you believe in me not as some kind of personal intellectual achievement, but rather as a gift of grace in which there is no place for smugness or self-righteousness. No one comes to that kind of answer that Peter gave through intellectual achievement or Bible bashing. You don't come to it through being born into a Christian family. You don't come to it through reading books or studying theology, although sometimes those things may help. But you don't come to it through getting in touch with your inner feelings. Rather, it comes to you and to the church as a gift from God. What does that mean then, both for us and for the church? Well, it means that we do not have the option of making up for ourselves who or what we think Jesus is. Who Jesus is not a subject to be debated, but a truth to be believed. And whenever we revert to socializing the gospel or reinterpreting what the church believes in order to have it fit in somehow with some kind of personal or societal belief, we've totally lost the plot. We've stepped outside of the church's confession of who Jesus is and into the world of heresy. You know, it's actually quite easy to determine where people or where organizations or other religious groups stand in relation to the Christian faith. Not in order to judge them, we'll leave that up to God. But simply ask them who they think Jesus is. Who is Jesus for you, for your organization, for your religious group, for you personally? And how should that answer determine how you live your life? The point is not what others believe. Jesus asked what the others believed, and then quite quickly he moves to the heart of the matter. Who do you say that I am? That's the question. Is Jesus just someone you revere as, in idiomatic Australian, a great bloke? Is he idolised simply as a great prophet or a moral example that we should attempt to emulate? Or is he truly, for you, the Messiah, the Son of the living God? But remember, whatever you personally believe, it doesn't change the truth of who Jesus is. The ultimate fate of others who do not confess what the church confesses regarding Christ is a matter between them and God. Your greatest concern is not what about them. Your concern should be, what about me? What do I say about Jesus? How does my life, in the way I go about the world, in the way I relate to others, in the words that I use, how does my life demonstrate that Jesus really is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Who is Jesus for you? To him be all glory, honor, majesty, and power. Amen.